Hello and welcome back to Technology Now, a weekly show from Hewlett-Packard Enterprise where we take what's happening in the world and explore how it's changing the way organizations are using technology. I'm your host for this week, Michael Bird, as Aubrey is away, but she will be back soon. So today we're discussing synthetic data. That is data trained by AI and computer simulations rather than gathered from the real world. Now, generating theoretical data is nothing new. We've been taking small samples of things and extrapolating from it for decades. And 9 out of 10 dentists, 90% of dogs, and 89% of Americans in a survey of 200 would agree. I mean, that's more extrapolation rather than synthetic data, but you do get the idea. Anyway, now though, with the advent of AI, we don't necessarily just need to extrapolate because synthetic data could get a whole lot more comprehensive and realistic. It could have huge implications for everything from privacy to research and even society at large. So it's about time we started talking about it. That means if you're the kind of person who needs to know why what's going on in the world matters to your organization, then this podcast is for you. And if you haven't yet done so, do make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice so you don't miss out. Right, let's get into it. Synthetic data has a long history. In fact, its history can be traced as far back as the study of physics itself, with missing data points filled in with theoretical information. The periodic table was originally filled with elements that hadn't yet proven to exist, some of which, like gallium, were later discovered, and some of which weren't quite right and never materialized. The first machine-generated synthetic data appeared in the 1930s, long before the invention of computers, when the first artificial voice generators were built, based off real-world recordings. But that's mostly interesting to me as a bit of a sound nerd, so we'll move on. The kind of synthetic data that we're talking about today, statistical analysis based off theoretical datasets modeled on real-world findings, was first developed by Harvard professor Donald Bruce Rubin in 1993. In the next couple of years, a huge amount of effort from a lot of very well-known statisticians refined the art. But at this point, it was still real-world data, mixed up, chopped up, and refined to hide the source. That's changing very rapidly, though, with the advent of AI and machine learning. But why? And why does it matter? Well, to spell it out for us, we're very pleased to welcome back to the podcast, friend of the show, Chief Technology Officer for AI at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, Matt Armstrong-Barnes. Matt, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me back.
So Matt, in the era of AI, what on earth is synthetic data?
The very first point to make is it's fake. So it is computer generated. But we have to bear in mind that it is done in a way that means that it bears the same statistical properties to some real data. It is one step away from reality. And there are a whole variety of techniques that you can use to create it, as well as some challenges that it is presenting. And there's quite a lot of active research in the area of how to use synthetic data in a safe way, but really that's going to drive AI technology forward probably quite extensively over the next 12 to 18 months.
So what generally is synthetic data being used for?
So if you think about it, there are some cases where you might not have all the data that you need in order to train an algorithm. And usually that comes in the form of underrepresented classes or edge cases. If I'm trying to build an AI that it looks at defects in manufacturing, I might have lots of very positive examples, but I don't have very negative examples. Or I might not have any data at all, so I need to synthetically create all of it. Instead of using statistical techniques, I'm using AIs to generate data, which is great because also it can classify things like what happens if I have a field that is missing. So I've sent out a questionnaire and some people decided not to fill in a certain question. So I can use either statistical techniques to work out on average other people filled the data in this way, or I can use an AI to predict what that response would have been, which gives me probably a greater degree of certainty over the data that I'm getting in from my sample set. So there are lots of great examples where using this technique can take either a small or non-existent data set and suddenly make it much larger and much more usable for training, ultimately, algorithms to create AI models.
But why is it needed? Because if you're using AI to create the data, and that data is being used by another AI to train a model, why can't that just create the data? It's just computers talking to computers.
It is. It's computer generated. And we do that because lots of data that we have available today, it doesn't have the right statistical distribution. So it might have 80% of one type of data and only 20% of another. And if I use that, my model will always bias towards the 80%. So what I need to do in those two class examples is use a technique to increase the distribution of the 20% to make it sort of 50-50. So you can either use statistical techniques as a way of bridging the gap between those two data sets, or I can start to get more complex, which is what we're seeing today, where I'm using generative AI techniques to bridge that data gap.
Yeah. So how is synthetic data made?
From a making it perspective, you've got a couple of key challenges. One is where you use real data as the basis for creating your synthetic data. So you synthesize more of what you've already got. Another way is if you don't have that data, you can simulate the scenario that would create that data and then take the output. Or you can gather, using questionnaires or expert knowledge, all of the information that you need and use that as a way of creating your synthetic data. Whereas what we're seeing in the industry is this move from synesthesia, from existing data, more into creating simulations that allow you to create data about those simulations that you can then use as a way of training algorithms without having to create those real-world situations. If I give you an example, if we're in the highly autonomous vehicle, we don't necessarily want to crash loads of cars, but we do want data about car crashes because we can feed that into our algorithm to help them avoid situations that would ultimately involve a collision. We can simulate that. We can create all of that in a digital world to help them understand what these situations are.
How much should we be relying on this sort of machine-generated synthetic data?
So we are seeing there's quite a lot of academic research with some great phrases like catastrophic forgetting and model collapse. And these are, if we start to step away from real world data, which as we know is very varied, the further we step away from that, the more synthetic it is. And that introduces changes in the distribution within artificial neural networks. And what that means is, if we train a model using real data, then we retrain it using synthetic data, then we train it again using synthetic data, it starts to understand the synthetic data better than the real data. Or we change the distribution in such a way that ultimately it will forget about the real data and only remember the synthetic data. And what we find is, as we use synthetic data to create synthetic data to create synthetic data, it becomes further steps away from reality.
It sounds a bit like when you get a key cut. You get a key cut off your master key, and then you get a key cut off that key that you got cut, and so on and so forth. Five iterations down the line, the key doesn't work in the door because it's like changed so subtly from the original master key that you originally had.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. We also have to bear in mind that it is situation dependent, so you can't replicate all different types of data. And secondly, if you are using personal data as your initial basis for synthesizing more data, you have to bear in mind that there are legal implications. So there's some loosely worded legislation within things like GDPR or HIPAA, if you're looking at healthcare, that have implications on how you're using algorithms with the data that you have. So it is all about making sure that you bring these techniques in, you understand what you're doing with them, but also how you ensure that you have an understanding of the continuum of the data that you have. And also you need to consider the fact that the decisions about how you handle outliers, how you clean your data, how it's wrangled in the first place, because that's really going to give you a good basis to start from.
So is this something that large organizations with big data science teams are using, or is this something that will be available in spreadsheet tools or in data modeling tools that you subscribe to?
Yeah, so I think if you view the, you know, huge fan of the open source community, there's been significant work happening in that space to build tools that will allow you to take an existing set of data and then synthesize it to create more. And a lot of those tools come out of straight statistical analysis so that you can make sure that you've got your classes represented. And really, you should be looking at these techniques whenever you use AI anyway to make sure that you've got the correct distribution of your data to try and remove bias. And then once you've got some good, strong understanding in that space and have already constructed some models, move to the next stage, which is starting to use generative techniques or simulation as a way of ultimately building bigger, larger data sets, which are going to have significant implications on the precision, recall, and accuracy of the models that you're producing. And then you can have a look at those to make sure that the models are operating within the defined parameters that you got and are driving the right kind of outcome.
Amazing. So to summarize, Matt, why should our listeners care about synthetic data?
What synthetic data is really going to do is it's going to increase the amount of data that we've got to train models. It's going to allow us to operate in a way where we can preserve people's privacy because we can synthetically create data instead of using the original data. But it also helps us address some of the historical constraints. The data that we're capturing has changed over time. And as a result, that means there's going to be gaps and potentially historical biases that are in that data. So by using some of these synthetic data techniques, it can allow us to harmonize the data that we've got so that we can create better, larger, and more accurate models going forward.
Matt, thank you very much. Fascinating as always. There's certainly loads to think about there. And we'll be back with you in a moment, Matt, so do not go anywhere. Right, now it is time for Today I Learned, the part of the show where we take a look at something happening in the world that we think you should know about. So, dear listener, what time is it where you are right now? Have a look at your phone, have a look at your watch. What time is it? Well, for me here in the UK, it is about 3:30 in the afternoon. But maybe a question that you might ask yourself is, what time is it on the moon? Well, that's the thing. Nobody knows, because the moon doesn't have a time zone. Each mission to the moon has its own individual time, formed from some mix of UTC, or Coordinated Universal Time, and the local clock at Mission Control. This method kind of works when you've just got one mission, but when lots of missions need to coordinate, which is likely to happen in the future, that whole system is going to fall apart. So NASA has been asked to create a new time zone, LTC, or Lunar Coordinated Time. Really cool. The thing is, time is odd. It moves at different speeds, as explained by Einstein's theory of relativity. And time moves very, very slightly faster on the moon due to its weaker gravity. It's not much, just a second or so every 50 years, but that's enough to make a big difference to very sensitive maneuvers, computer calculations, and scientific measurements. That means that LTC might need its own clock system with occasional leap seconds to keep time with Earth. And to complicate matters more, this is something the European Space Agency is working on too. They'll have to come together to make an agreement between themselves at some point. And whilst the new time zone will have to be slightly quicker than Earth's, it'll also have to be worked out, well, quickly. NASA wants moon time to be in place by 2026, before the next generation of crewed missions begins. Well, the things you learn on this podcast, eh? Literal time travel. Right, now it is time to return to our guest, Matt Armstrong-Barnes, to talk about synthetic data. So Matt, all of this plays into something called the creativity equation for AI. Can you explain what that is and why it matters?
Oh yeah, so the creativity equation, if I were to take artificial intelligence at a very high level, it's X times W equals Y. So X is the input times W, which is the weights inside the artificial neural network, will give us a prediction, which is Y, or Y hat for the mathematicians. So that means if I were to take a picture, times it by the weights, that will give me a prediction as to what is in the picture. And where we're seeing the creativity equation start to shift is, if I say, where is creativity in X times W equals Y? The answer is X. The images that I'm putting in the first place. And historically, that has been the realm of human beings. We are the ones that are creating the images that we are then using to create the weights, which allows the models to create their predictions. With generative AI and synthetic data that is being created, we're seeing models create X. And in that equation, are we moving towards generative techniques using synthetic data? That means artificial intelligence is moving towards the realm of it being creative.
Wow. I guess what you're saying is synthetic data is sort of the data equivalent of generative AI writing essays or generating pictures.
Ah, so I think what we have to bear in mind is generative AI today, using things like large language models or diffusion techniques, really are using probabilistic techniques to create the next word in the sentence. So this is where we get into the point, is that creativity or is that just probabilistic maths working out the next most logical word in a sequence? When we start thinking about synthetic data, we are creating new forms of data that hadn't existed before. Does that mean that the next evolution of algorithms will ultimately be creating instead of just using probabilistic maths?
So Matt, overall, what are the potential impacts of synthetic data and why should we be paying attention to it?
So I think that there are some pros and cons of the use of synthetic data, with the pros being it allows us to take the next evolutionary steps on the AI journey. So the next step is to say, well, actually, we need to create data that doesn't exist today to allow the models to be better and deeper and have a better outcome. What that creates from a sort of probably negative viewpoint is it reduces the creativity that we need as human beings to create things in the first place to input them into the algorithms.
Matt, thank you so much. It's been great to talk. And listeners, you can find more information on the topics discussed in today's episode in the show notes. All right, we are getting towards the end of the show, which means it is time for This Week in History, a look at monumental events in the world of business and technology, which has changed our lives. Now, the clue last week was it's 1999, and this virus went nuclear. It was, of course, the attack of the Chernobyl computer virus, which was the first known computer virus to attack the flash BIOS of PCs. The virus was actually released a year beforehand with a coordinated attack date of April 26th. It was developed by a Taiwanese student who left his initials, CIH, in the code. Virus scanners at the time didn't pick it up because the virus code wasn't tacked onto the end of infected software, but spread throughout it, taking up any empty space it could find so as to not arouse suspicion. When it hit, over 60 million infected PCs had critical data overwritten, which completely disabled them, causing over $1 billion in damages. The date happened to coincide with the anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, hence the nickname that eventually stuck. Ouch. Next week, we've got something rather special for you being released on May 4th. So there's unfortunately no This Week in History. But the clue for the week after, that's the week of the 6th of May, is it's 1886 and this invention may have been dry, but it sure had a spark. You know what it is? I'm not sure I do. Anyway, do keep it to yourself. And that, of course, brings us to the end of Technology Now for this week. And thank you so much to our guest, Matt Armstrong-Barnes, Chief Technology Officer for AI at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. And to you, thank you so much for joining us. Technology Now is hosted by Aubrey Lovell and myself, Michael Bird. And this episode was produced by Sam Datapoulin and Al Booth, with production support from Harry Morton, Zoe Anderson, Alicia Kempson, Alison Paisley, Alyssa Mitri, Camilla Patel, and Chloe Sewell. Our social editorial team is Rebecca Wissinger, Judy Ann Goldman, Katie Guarino, and our social media designers are Alejandra Garcia, Carlos Alberto Suarez, and Ambar Maldonado. Technology Now is a Lower Street production for Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, and we'll see you the same time, the same place next week. Cheers.